Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop. For this Tuesday, August 27th, I'm Ray Graff. We talk antiques today, and we welcome Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas of Stair Galleries in Hudson, New York. Founded by Colin Stair, a fourth-generation furniture specialist, and featuring a team of experts with over 150 years of combined experience, Stair is one of the leading regional auction houses in America. So if you think you found the hidden treasure and you need help figuring it out, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is that number, 800-348-2551, or you can email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Antiques right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We are discussing antiques today with Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas of Stair Galleries in Hudson, New York. Colin is a fourth-generation furniture specialist. He worked for Sotheby's in New York and England before opening Stair in 2001. He was an early innovator of online auction technology and has successfully balanced the expectations of the modern marketplace with the old-school charm of the traditional auction house. Lisa Thomas is director of the Fine Arts Department at Stair. She began in the Department of Paintings and Sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. At Christie's, Lisa was in charge of contemporary prints at multiples and was also responsible for the appraisal and sales of 20th-century European-American and historical American prints. She has been a specialist on Antiques Roadshow already. The number to call with your question is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Give you a few minutes to rummage around in the attic and find something and give us a call. Colin and Lisa, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you being here today. Tell us a little more about Stair. I always heard it as Stair Galleries, but you just call it Stair.
Yeah, we just sort of shifted to just Stair and making it simple that way. It's an old family business. Yeah. My grandfather and great-grandfather started in London and New York. They were antique dealers, very different from auction people. And it just sort of seemed simpler and a little bit easier. So we just refer to us as ourselves as Stair these days. And it is the second oldest profession in the world, I would say. So we are...
Do they tie in at all?
Not yet, okay, right, but the day's still young.
Fair enough.
We offer about 9 or 10,000 objects a year for sale and about 30 different auctions. And we promote those with very vigorous catalogs and lots of information. We're information gatherers, putting all that information into a catalog, emailing it out to 15 or 20,000 people, and you just see who bites. And luckily, people have bit from all around the world.
When did you start with the online auctions?
We started printing our first catalogs online in 2001.
Wow.
People were like, you're crazy.
Yeah.
This is never going to work. You need to have a printed catalog. I'd left Sotheby's. And they're like, no. And slowly, it just took off. And that catalog now gets shared several hundred thousand times through other aggregators and bidding platforms, yeah. Right, Lisa?
Well, and with COVID, we saw such a strong shift to online bidding.
So you were positioned when that pandemic hit.
We were well ahead of it and ready to go. So we didn't suffer at all during the pandemic in terms of our business and our business model. We'd been selling online for years, and we were able to just keep going. At the beginning of the pandemic, we actually conducted sales from our homes,
yeah,
where we all phone bid with clients from our living rooms.
Did you like that?
I did, actually.
Couldn't stand it.
Well,
Colin didn't like it. I enjoyed being home, but...
More people, more better.
You know, I've been to your website, which, by the way, is a really nice website.
Yeah.
And one of the things you mention is that we have a kind of a customizable and expandable space.
Right.
So I take it, Colin, that you like having in-person events.
Any way it works really is fine. But, you know, the old days of having 200 people in a room with 2 cases of wine and 1,000 miniature hot dogs and blankets.
Is that how it works?
That's how it worked.
I have to bid to eat the hot dogs?
No, it was all free, and it was great entertainment. But the world just changed, and that's okay. And now we're talking to literally thousands of people as we have an auction online, right? Apparently so.
But what we still do in person, which we, Colin and I both love and our staff loves, is that we do extended exhibitions for all of our sales. So we set up everything that's in the catalog for sale in our gallery space and make it look beautiful so people can come in person to see it. And regardless of all of the online bidding and that seismic shift to online everything, we still have a lot of people who like to come see things in person.
Absolutely.
And we love that because we love seeing our clients and we love talking about the stuff.
You learn so much, Ray. Every single day we learn. I learn five new things, something I didn't know the day before, learn about a new subject, an artist that I didn't know anything about. It is fascinating. And you learn more when people come to visit you and tell you what you don't know sometimes. Right, Lisa?
Absolutely.
The number here is 800-348-2551 if you want to talk to our experts today. Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas from Stair Galleries, or just Stair, if you will, in Hudson, New York. 800-348-2551. That's the telephone number. Lisa, your CV is pretty darn impressive.
Thank you, Ray.
When you are setting these, do you set the prices for some of these things?
We do. We create the estimates. I work with all of the fine arts, so painting, sculpture, works on paper, photography. And there's a little bit of a science to coming up with an estimated value. And then there's a little bit of subjectiveness that gets thrown in.
And subjectiveness and detectiveness, I imagine.
A little bit.
I showed you a news item about somebody who had found a bunch of signed prints allegedly by Salvador Dali.
By Dali, right.
And you said, well, there are a lot of fakes out there.
Well, there are. There are, with specific artists who became popular and valuable in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and Salvador Dali happens to be one of them, Picasso, Miro, Chagall, some of the other European artists. It became very easy to reproduce facsimiles or fakes and forgeries of their printed work because prints are made in multiples. So there's not just one. People would reproduce them and then apply fake or unauthorized signatures and numbering to them. So you do have to be a little bit careful with some things. But if you're buying from a reputable dealer or a reputable auction house, you've had the right people vet it and you can feel comfortable.
The vetting I find interesting, and that sort of gets to what I was mentioning when I said detective work.
Mm-hmm.
There could be some darn good fakes. We do a coin and stamp show, and you know these guys say, well, the fakes are very ingenious. They're usually one step ahead of
the
experts.
They are.
Some of the fakes can actually be worth money over the long run.
It's true. The technology has gotten to a point where you can reproduce works of art so that it's virtually impossible to tell that they're not the originals. So you do have to be careful. With prints, it's a little bit easier. Because there's a catalog raisonné for all of these artists. That's sort of the compendium of all of the artists' printed work. It's like the Bible for that artist. And I use it as a reference point to compare line by line, for example, a Dali print, and make sure that it matches up exactly to what the original is supposed to look like and that the size of the paper is exact. And that if it has a watermark in the paper, it matches perfectly. So you have to do your due diligence and make sure. And you also, you know, we have between all of our specialists years and years and years of experience. And it's all in our head and our eyes. And that's what, you know, we bring to the research when we're estimating.
You're both pretty passionate about this, are you?
We are.
Yeah, it's a bit of a nerdy thing, you know.
Oh, I mean, it's cool, though.
Yeah, I mean, Lisa and I just went to Maastricht in the southern Netherlands just to walk around an art fair for 3 days and see the 300-plus exhibitors and take in everything. And it was just absolutely fascinating. We look at a lot of fairs. We don't look at a lot of other auctions, I'll say, but we look at dealers who are reselling things, and it's really, really interesting. There's Lisa sees a lot of exhibitions, shows, more current. So you have to keep enriching yourself, don't you? I mean, you need to fill the tank and just be exposed and just see as much as you possibly
and
can.
And auction house people, specialists in particular, are just we're passionate about the things. That's how most of us got into the business, and that's what keeps us interested.
Yeah.
And like our buyers who are looking to discover something at auction, it's the hunt and the discovery that I think really keeps us going and excited. I mean, we love nothing more than going on a visit into somebody's old barn and finding some sure. amazing painting or an old clock or piece of furniture. I mean, it really, we still, after doing this for years and years, it's really exciting.
How many misses before you get a hit when you do that sort of thing?
Quite a few.
60 to 1.
60 to 1?
That's going to be my number
yeah.
today.
But listen, when you hit it big. Like, yeah. for example, the Fabergé
moment was the
figure
thing.
Figure was yeah. just found in an attic in yeah. Dutchess County and ended up being a $6 million
wow.
item
yeah.
for us. So yeah.
$6 million.
Yeah.
$6 million pretty impressive.
Wrapped in an attic for 50 years.
Yeah. Incredible.
Forgotten about.
Yeah.
Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas are here from Stair Galleries in Hudson, New York. It's Antiques Today. If you have a question, 800-348-2551. We'll take a break in a moment, then we'll hit the phones. Lisa, I got to ask you, in your introduction, it said you have been a specialist on Antiques Roadshow. It's not a show I watch very often, but we happened, a couple of my daughters and I stumbled upon it over the weekend and watched what a cool show. What did you
yeah.
do?
That show, it's got quite a following, and it's been around forever.
Yeah.
So I did it when I worked at Christie's, so this is going back many, many years. And you sit at a table just the way it looks on TV, and people line up, and they bring their items to you, and you look at them. And if you spot something at your table that has promise or could be valuable, you flag down one of the producers, and then you go one-on-one with the person and tell them. They tell you where they got it, maybe they inherited it, what they know about it, and then you break the good or sometimes bad news to them on what it's worth.
But a lot of the times on the TV show, you're seeing just the good news, right?
You're right. That's what they're looking for.
One in 60. Right?
It's so yeah. funny. I mean, David Tripp and Bob Scott are here, and they do the stamp and coin show. And Bob Scott, in particular, with the stamp, someone said, "I got 1,000 stamps." So, well, I hate to break the news to you. All right, let's take a quick break. 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop today, and it's Lisa Thomas and Colin Stair. Your calls coming up. Ron Carter and the group Loose Change here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Lisa Thomas and Colin Stair are here to take your antique calls, and they are from Stair Galleries in Hudson, New York. You can call it Stair. Let's grab a couple of emails here before we get to the phones. By the way, in the break, Colin, you said you actually do auctioneering.
Yeah, I buy probably 3,000 or 4,000 or so lots a year, and we have three other very highly trained auctioneers that are also really terrific.
Is it fun?
I guess it's one of those jobs that I wouldn't miss if I didn't have to.
So you don't like it that much?
No, I like it, but I've done it for a long time.
Because I was going to invite you to be on the fun drive and take care of that.
But I'm pretty good at it. I've done hundreds of charity auctions as well. And now it's a very visual thing with people watching on camera.
Yeah.
So it's a whole new world.
Now, I've only never been to an auction, obviously. I've never been most places, but, in the Bond movies or whatever, they. If you
scratch the nose,
you scratch a
nose,
touch your head or something.
No, can tell when you have a room full of people in the old days, and you can see the people shift in their seat and they grab their paddle and they look at their partner, and you could tell it's about to get going.
Interesting.
And then maybe somebody jumps in the end at $10,000, and it's very exciting. It's still exciting. It still plays out the same way, but just a little differently.
When you set prices in radio or any media, one of the rules is know your audience.
Sure.
Okay. Well, this group is exceptionally well-heeled. We'll just put a little bit up on the price.
No, we just take this very conservative estimate approach, don't we, Lisa? We
yeah.
just want to keep it fair and no bad surprises and make sure we can find a home for everything.
So,
yeah.
Let's go to the phones. 800-34—do a couple emails first. Hang in there on the phones. This is from Chris. My family has enjoyed more than 200 Thanksgivings on a Cuban mahogany dining table. Is it worth more as a piece of wood to a builder than as a table these days?
It just completely depends on the style and the period in which it was made. You know, there's a lot of things that are called Cuban mahogany that may or may not be. Mahogany came from all over South America and Africa, as well as Cuba, Jamaica. So it may very well be, but it sounds like it's pretty high quality. But if it's a Georgian dining table, so 1760, 70, 80, it could be worth $10,000, $20,000. So if it's a pedestal, it's got a central pedestal and a rectangular top and nice old color. But if it's 1840, 1850, maybe not quite as valuable. Just send us a picture. We're happy to take a look.
You know, art being a separate category here, but it amazes me in some of these collectible shows I have done, age really doesn't. Something being really old doesn't automatically mean, oh, you got something there.
No. It's also style and taste. I think, you know, that same dining table that's 100 years later, if it's good looking, I mean, that's still going to really make all the difference. So happy to always look at pictures and give somebody a very, very good idea about what we can do with that.
What do you know about furniture repair?
Well,
quite a lot.
All right. Well,
quite a bit.
Christiane wrote in saying, do you know how to repair old oak dining chairs that have gotten wiggly?
The wiggly chairs, yes. very simply, yourself, it's kind of hard to do. The best thing to do is find somebody qualified around you. You can write us. We can give you a couple of recommendations wherever you are. But it's basically putting glue on those joints and then being able to tighten the chair with some way. People would tie a string around it and tie it tight, and that would pull the chair back together, let the glue set. It's not terribly complicated, but it's not something maybe you want to tackle on the first go by
yourself.
Or
just try it on some lousy chairs.
Or try some really lousy chairs.
Which is what I do. All right, one more email, then we'll go to the phones. Yeah. This is Vox Pop. We are doing antiques today. Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas from Stair in Hudson, New York. This is from Brian in Buffalo. I inherited two Dali lithos. I'm aware of the questions regarding if the Dali signature on the litho paper is in fact his and other concerns with the work. I believe Lisa mentioned a process to determine the authenticity of the work. How would one begin that process?
Well, probably the first thing to do is to show it to somebody who has some knowledge base in that area. And I would say I'd be happy to look at a photograph of it. In the end, you probably need somebody to look at it in person. You can do a few things at home to eliminate some of the obvious problems. One, if you can take it out of the frame, if it's framed carefully, and look at it under magnification. If it is really reproduced using a photomechanical technique, you're going to see the little Benday dots that sort of look like a Xerox. Sometimes you can see them with the naked eye, but you can always see them with a magnifying glass. So that would be the first thing to do at home, would be to take a good look at it and also to look at the signature, because some of the reproductions are actually reproducing not only the image, the work of art itself, but also the signature.
The exact signature.
So to the naked eye, it might look like it's signed in pencil or pen the way it's meant to be. But if you look at it with a magnifying glass, you may be able to see that it's actually a printed signature. And then beyond that, really, you need to have somebody with the proper research tools to look at it for you.
Well, let me ask you a question for an amateur. You know, if you think you have something valuable in a frame, do you want to be at home taking it out of that frame, or do you want to pass it off to somebody who knows how to not harm it?
It's a good question. I would say if it's framed with glass, because it's a work on paper, if the glass breaks, it could damage the paper. So, yes, be very judicious in how you handle the frame. But some things are framed easily and the backs just pop right off and you can easily take it apart. So if it's in an old frame from, you know, the 50s or 60s, you probably don't want to mess around with it.
Fair enough. All right, let's go to the phones. You ready?
Cool.
Let's do this thing. We'll go to Calvin in Woodstock. Calvin, you're up.
Hello.
Hey, man, can you turn your radio down just a little bit?
I just turned it off.
Thank you very much. All right, go ahead. You're on.
Okay, so I've been wanting to call you folks at Stair, so this is convenient, thank you. I have a Biedermeier, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, side chair from Sweden, 1830s. It's really quite a remarkable piece because it's so modern for that time period. It just seems interesting to me. I've given it a little bit of research. Obviously, I'm wondering if this is the sort of thing that your company's interested in. And I might have one other thing I want to ask you about.
One thing I should tell you and everybody else who calls, We're not, it's public radio, so we're not doing that kind of business on the air.
Right.
So general information, yes. Setting up appointments, absolutely not. We'll lose our FCC license. So with that said, go ahead, great. Colin.
Well, Calvin, I could tell you a little bit about
Biedermeier. Tell me what you know.
Yeah, Biedermeier Furniture, particularly sort of made in the, let's call it the Austro-Hungarian Empire. One of my best friends wrote the book on Biedermeier Furniture, Angus Wilkie. You could start there by buying a copy of that book and doing a little research yourself. There was one great major designer named Danhauser at that period that did a lot of designs. 1830 is a little bit late, so you're out of the sort of neoclassical period. Biedermeier Furniture as a market has come down quite a bit, so there's that change. But it's a really, really fascinating group of furniture. It's generally very neoclassical. Could be made in Czechoslovakia, Austria, Hungary, and it generally hovered around that part of the world. There's a lot of great things. There's Biedermeier collectors. There's been great Biedermeier dealers. We've sold one of the greats inventories, Niall Smith. So drop us a line, send us a picture, and I'll send you everything that I know about them. But doing a little homework on your own, you'd enjoy this book, Biedermeier by Angus Wilkie. Absolutely fascinating.
Calvin, thanks a lot. Now, you know, it's funny you bring up this book. Mm. When I do collectible shows of various stripe coin stamps, you know, comics, baseball cards, whatever, there's always one, basically a Bible.
There is.
The furniture world is so vast.
Yeah.
Can there be some sort of a...
No. I think we probably in our building have about 5,000 books.
Wow.
And do we use them less every year? Yes. But when you go, recently, somebody was sitting in our office that we work with, and she was casually flipping through treasures of state and things that belong to the government, and there was a plate on the pages that was in the State Department's collection, and it was downstairs in the first floor.
Wow.
So, and we had a piece of furniture that matched in the Dictionary of English Furniture, which is an old publication. So every once in a while, it all comes together.
I think I saw, and maybe I have the old master wrong, but I think I saw someone found they had had it for years, an old Rembrandt recently. Am I wrong about that, Lisa?
Possibly. An old Rembrandt painting?
Yeah, like, not unknown, but mm-hmm. one that was just gone for a long, long time. When something like that turns up, and it happens, how does that vetting process and the detective work begin?
Yeah, well, it's really complicated for an artist like Rembrandt because obviously the value level is so high. There are experts in the field who would be contacted immediately, and there's so much documentation of those high-value artists. So that would be a really high-level research
project.
That
would be a committee in most cases.
Really?
I mean, we just saw it in Amsterdam. There was the Standard Bearer. Was that a Rembrandt? Mm-hmm. That was a somewhat recent discovery.
Right.
And that ended up in the Rijksmuseum, which has the most important collection of old master pictures.
Do you like doing that detective work yourself?
I love doing the research. And we do a lot of research at Stair. It's just for paintings of a lower value level. But we still need to document them as best we can. We have a very good in-house library, but we also go to the library at the Met, the Watson. I use the Frick Library a lot in the city. We do use the internet a lot, but you really have to go back to some of the books to really do thorough research. But we track things down as far as we can, and because all of the specialists at Stair worked at Christie's or Sotheby's at one point, we have really good connections to old colleagues that we can lean on and ask for opinions.
Lisa Thomas and Colin Stair are here from Stair Galleries in Hudson, New York. It's 800-348-2551. Don't call at this second because there are no open lines. But when you hear somebody hang up, that's a good time to try it. Let's go to Rhinebeck. Ann, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I have an antique grandfather clock. It's probably from around the 1820s, 1850s. It's got some inlay. It's very pretty. It has some flowers on all the four corners. It still works, although it could probably use a little bit of a tune-up. It has some chips in the veneer. I'm just wondering, is this something that is valuable and I can sell?
And there should be a name inscribed on the front of the clock, probably sort of in the movement, in the white painted face. And a lot of those times, those movements are made in England. It could be an American clock. It could be an English clock. I will say overall, here's the bad news, is that the antique market is a bit down. So what a clock that might have cost $20,000 25 years ago might be worth $2,000 to $3,000 today.
Oh boy, that's
so
a big drop.
Yeah, it is. The tastes have changed, times have changed, but it could be a really nice thing. And I mean, so for instance, if it was made in England in 1760, 80, or 1820, it could be worth $2,000 to $3,000. But if it was made in America and it was rare, it could be worth more considerably. So drop us a line very simply at the gallery.
Okay, Ann, thanks a lot. Appreciate it very much. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. A couple things about that. One, Ann mentioned maybe it needs a tune-up. I had heard that if you mess with old antique things, that you may damage the value in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, repair, maintenance, restoration, it's so very tricky. I think she was in Rhinebeck. There just happens to be a great clock restorer that's in Rhinebeck that works on the mechanical part of the movement. So you just need to get somebody very qualified.
And the other thing you said was, you know, the market's down over the last
20
years.
It is.
One thing in the course of doing some of these shows during the pandemic, which was a real treat, by the way, a lot of these markets, not necessarily antiques, but comics, collectibles, cards, things like that, stamps, coins. They had a little spike during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Did you see that as well in antiques?
We saw it, and it went cuckoo bananas because
but it's back down.
Yeah, well, I think people just couldn't go out to a restaurant. They couldn't hop on a plane and go someplace. They couldn't travel. And so I think they sort of were doing this feeding thing at auction and from dealers, and business was quite good, especially in the collectibles market.
Excellent. Number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. It's Antiques Today with Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas, and let's now go to Albany, New York. Eddie, you're up.
Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Yeah. I got some old postcards from the early 1900s. It was from a house that we had bought, and the owner used to be the old postmasters. Huh. And we got probably about 100 from the early 1900s. And I was wondering if there is any way you guys deal with that or...
Postcards. Okay.
Postcards.
From the 1900s.
Yeah, that's a very niche area of collectibles. And there are auction houses and dealers all across the country that specialize in these really niche collectible markets. I love old postcards just because of the history of them. They're fascinating. The value is really going to depend on several variables, one of them being rarity, the other one being the nature of the subject matter, and then some other, you know, sort of more esoteric variables that if you spoke with a dealer who specializes in vintage postcards, you'd really be able to sort of flesh out what you have and what the value might be. I'm afraid we probably can't be more help than that. We don't actually sell postcards at Stair because there are these collectible markets that are so focused and narrow, and it's really best to go to the specialist dealer.
And there's so few of them. I mean, there are so many of them that there is a handful that are worth a lot.
Right. It's like baseball cards,
yeah.
Or right. There's so many of them out there, and you need to really, really know and specialize in that area to be able to identify what the really rare, special ones
and
are.
And they're mass produced. Right?
And they are mass produced.
And it sounds like this is the postmaster. It sounds like a lot of undeliverable mail.
Yeah, it could be. Could be.
Eddie, thank you very much for the call. I suppose if Teddy Roosevelt had signed it and sent it, then or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, let's see here. We'll go to Richmond, Massachusetts, and it's Pam's turn. Hello, Pam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I bought a metal pen, black ink on woven paper, picture of a dancer by Emlyn, signed by Emlyn Edding in an upper state New York barn sale for like $8.
Okay.
find of the century. And it was improperly framed. So there's foxing and staining and glue from tape that was used to keep it in the frame. So I took it to the Williamstown Art Conservation Center.
They're wonderful
and
there.
I got three estimates for fixing it from like $2,300 down to $850. So three separate ways to conserve it. But what I'm wondering is, I don't know how much it is. You know, so is it even worth $2,300? Is it worth $850?
Sure. That's a really great question. And the condition of works on paper is really paramount because the paper itself is actually a very integral part of the artwork itself. So when you have a work on paper that has conservation issues and damages, it is good to try to repair them, or if not repair them, just to steady them so they don't worsen over time. I'm not familiar with this artist. I'd love to see what it looks like. But there's so many really talented artists out there who don't have what we call an established secondary market at auction. And so just the fact that I'm not familiar with the name just means that it's an artist whose work doesn't come up at auction regularly. Doesn't mean that there's no value there. So I'd love to see what it looks like, and I could maybe give you some more information. But in terms of the value of restoration, it really becomes just a personal decision on how much is that work of art worth to you and how much do you want to spend to conserve it and save it for the future, knowing that paper is so delicate and those kind of foxing issues will likely worsen over time.
All right, this is a great time. Is there a contact email that people can get in touch with you?
Yeah, just information at Stair Galleries.
Information, full word, information at Stair Galleries. Yep. Stair, like your stairs in your house. Stair.
And galleries, plural. Yep.
Okay, Stair Galleries. Yeah, that way if somebody does have a question, we're not repeating it over and over.
So, right, thank you.
And I do have a link to your website on our page for today. So, with that said, let's take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Lisa Thomas and Colin Stair from Stair Galleries are here. We'll check the email bag and then hit the phones. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. You're there. And across from me, Lisa Thomas and Colin Stair from Stair Galleries in Hudson, New York. The number is 800-348-2551. Before we get to the email back, what's the craziest, wildest thing you guys have ever auctioned over there?
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Well, no livestock.
Okay, well, that's good.
that's good. And I think it would have to be our little Russian Fabergé figure
right. In
2014, which we sold for $5.2 million. On the phone, plus
the buyer's premium, bringing it over $6
million. Wow.
that is the most expensive, but it was definitely the most exciting from the moment that it came in the door to the moment of discovery and over again, and then having this object looked at and then seeing people react to it. And it was royal. So it belonged to Tsar Nicholas II and his family.
Yeah.
And the last record was about $1 million for one of these figures. And that provenance pushed it over the edge.
That's crazy. So without violating the auctioneer's HIPAA regulations or whatever, did the person, you watch the Antiques Roadshow, and one of the best parts is watching the people's reaction when they, this is worth £40,000. What did the person do when you said, oh, gosh, this is worth millions?
It was a very cool conversation over a tuna fish sandwich at a beloved institution called Earth Foods in Hudson.
Yeah.
And we set the estimate at $400,000 to $800,000. And he took a pause and he goes, well, that would be nice.
Yes, it would.
And he was just the nicest person. And this had been sitting in this attic for 50 years. The woman who owned it probably fell on slightly hard times. She owned a farm and a horse farm. She was just struggling a little bit. And it sure would have been nice that she was alive and had that money in her hands at some point. But it went to a lot of great family members who needed the money. So
that is
fantastic. Awesome.
All right. Denise Menanz writes, my late sister had tons of cobalt blue glass. Is there a market for it?
Minimal. Not great. It generally tends to be the second half of the 19th century and onwards. But nothing is better than beautiful cobalt glass, candlelight on a dining table in the wintertime. Absolutely stunning.
And then a nice Arby's meal to go with it.
And a nice Arby's sandwich to go with
delicious.
It.
Delicious.
Taco Tuesday.
Valerie writes in, I have a small drop leaf dining table. I think it's maple. Overall design looks like Empire to me, but the legs are turned exactly like a Michael Allison table I saw in a museum collection. What is the table, earlier or Empire?
Strange. So it's, if it's Michael Allison they're referencing is an American New York cabinet maker. So we probably want to be about 1815, 1825, somewhere in that neighborhood. So, but he generally worked in mahogany, but not exclusively. So it could be solid maple, could be a little tiger maple. It could be a country cousin of that table. So that style was replicated all over the Northeast and New England. So it sort of started in New York based on a Georgian or a Regency design and then migrated out into the wilds.
All right, one more email here for now, and then we'll go back to the phones. Lisa Thomas and Colin Stair are here from Stair Galleries in Hudson, New York. Cassandra writes, my parents lived in Liberia in the late 1950s and were given a genuine leopard skin purse, which I still have. I know this is an illegal trade. Is there anywhere to sell it? Well, now we've strayed into illegal territory, so maybe I should pre-read these.
Yes. I think the simple answer is no.
No. No. Give it back to the leopard it came from.
Yes, yes, yes.
All right, let's go to the phones, and we'll go to Colerain. Peggy, you're on.
Hello. I'm interested in finding out whether an offer that was made by a friend to a family member for a Raphael Sawyer print is... how to figure out if it's an appropriate offer.
Well, we're trying to stay away out of the transactional sort of thing here.
Oh,
today,
yeah. Sure.
I think.
Yeah.
So I think that, but Lisa, you could speak a little to the artist because he was so interesting.
And we could just give a little advice that there are plenty of resources online where you can check the value of works of art, especially prints, because as I said earlier, they're made in multiples. So there's a pretty good chance that a similar one has come up at auction. And I think some Googling... Mm-hmm. We'll probably pull up some numbers for you. But yes, Raphael Sawyer was an American realist, painter, and prolific printmaker, mostly lithographs. He had two brothers who were also artists. He made a lot of prints, and they do come up very regularly at auction with values anywhere from $50 to probably $2,000 or $3,000, depending on the image. And I think you could, if you know the title, or you could do a Google image search with your phone, and I think you will land upon some pricing that'll be helpful to you.
All
but
right.
There's Raphael, Moses,
and Isaac.
I've never heard of Isaac. That's to see five new things a day.
See, you've learned.
This is number three.
Raphael is the best known of the brothers.
Best, yeah.
You know, in your bio, it says at Christie's you were responsible, Lisa, for in charge of contemporary prints at multiples. What's the difference between a print and a multiple?
That's a good question. A print is a multiple.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Right? But then multiples also can be three-dimensional. So sometimes artists will create an object. Think of the Jeff Koons dog, for example, the balloon dog, created in editions of 10, 20, 100. So that's considered a multiple, where it's an object, but it's additioned.
And so I assume the more there are of them, the less an individual would be worth.
Correct.
Okay, let's go back to our phone lines to Brimfield, Massachusetts. Edward, you're on with Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas.
Good afternoon. I have a couple of John Gould 19th century hand-colored lithographs.
Mm-hmm.
They're about 12 by 16 matted and framed. And there are two species of bluebirds.
Okay.
I purchased them many decades ago, back when Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In program was popular.
You remember that, Lisa?
I don't.
She wasn't allowed to watch TV as a kid.
I didn't think so.
How's your bird?
It was a familiar saying on there about the bluebird of happiness.
Oh, yeah, flying up your nose.
And I'm just wondering, based on what has happened to Audubon's prints due to the way he collected his subjects, is the same did the same thing happen to John Gould?
Yes. I mean, they worked in a very similar way. John Gould was an English ornithologist, as I'm sure you know, and published monographs on birds where they were printed and then hand-colored, and they were bound into books that were purchased usually on subscription. And what's happened over the years is that people have cut the pages out of these bound books and framed them individually. So it sounds like you have two plates, we call them, from one of these bound books of ornithology. And yes, there has been criticism on the way these 19th century ornithologists dealt with the animals that they were reproducing. In the case of Audubon, he drew and did watercolors of the animals, the birds, and then they were reproduced in print form. John Gould did the same. So there is some issue with it. However, I don't think that those issues have really affected the secondary market value of these prints in the long run. You know, they've sort of retained their value despite that.
All right, Edward, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. We'll get this in several times here. Once again, if people want to contact you guys at Stare Galleries, how do they do that?
Just simply information@staregalleries.com.
Okay. Yeah. So if you have more detailed questions, although I imagine you get a zillion emails.
We get a lot. Yeah. We have one person monitoring this channel, as it were, pretty much all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, we love the questions.
Fair enough.
And you never know, right? Right?
Well, in my case, I know. By the way, you know, contemporary prints, we talked about the value going down on the Audubon and everything else. When I was a kid, I grew up in the 70s. Everybody had Leroy Neiman prints. As a child, I did not like them. But are they holding any value today?
To be perfectly honest, not a lot. They went through this very popular period, and they just really haven't held up.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a narrow niche collecting area, and I think specifically the sports related ones for people who collect sports memorabilia. There is still some interest there. I would say that the younger generations of collectors have not gone in that direction. And so,
not yet.
Right. Everything's cyclical.
It could come back.
All right. Let's go back to our phone lines here. We'll go to Troy. It's Kathy. Hello, Kathy.
Hello, Ray and company. How are you today?
Hey, not too bad. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Dear guests, I've looked all over the internet for this, so that's why I'm bothering you. I can't seem to get an answer to my question. I have a friend who has a complete nativity set made by Henri. So it has the manger and Mary and Joseph and Jesus. It has the shepherds and all their affiliated animals and the three wise men and... It's a wooden carved. It's small. They're probably not more than 3 inches high, and they're in really good condition. She's looking to downsize and move out of her house, and so these would probably be part of a garage sale or something. And I'm curious as to whether that
I think that's the
item
right...
has held its value or has it gone the way of the Hummels.
I think that's a very good question. And I think that's so interesting about these nativity sets is that people think of them as this 20th century thing, but these nativity sets in figures in large and small in Italy were a part of this holiday in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century. So it's a wonderful tradition to carry on, to keep, to pass through family members. I have ones that belong to my great-grandfather that I just cherish. At the long and short of it, they're not worth a lot of money, Kathy, I'm afraid. And I think the avenue of an estate sale, garage sale, whatever the case may be, would be something nice. And they're certainly worth, I think, under $500. But if you could pass them along to a loving family member, all the better. We love to donate things.
Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Kinderhook, and it's Jerry's turn. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, Ray. Thank you so much. This is a great show. I'm learning so much.
Thank you.
I have a single iron bed. It's probably 150 years old, having known who slept on it. And I was just wondering, it has the footboard and the headboard, very pretty rosettes. is this something that's sellable on a garage sale, or what's my best venue for getting rid of it?
Jerry, probably a very, very good question, because there was just millions and millions and millions of these made.
Iron beds,
headboards, footboards, together with a mattress that was joined by chain. So there's lots and lots of them, and we spend half our life sleeping, right? So what could be more important?
And how portable they are.
How
bring
portable
them up to a fourth floor walk-up.
But unfortunately, the world has just not been kind to that market, and people don't want to sleep in those types of beds anymore, so they're not worth a lot of money. I'm going to hazard a big wild guess that we're under a couple of $100, I would think, in a tag sale. But
okay.
As I said, always drop us a line, and I think there's always something to be learned.
Are there always outliers to all these things?
There's 100% outliers.
Yeah.
So now you've got a British campaign bed made in 1810, and it went on the Napoleonic campaign, and it fit into a camphorwood box. There's no exception, so that's why it's just like always check and then double check and then check again one more time.
Jerry.
Thank you so much.
Did
I appreciate
that help?
It.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Let's go to Saugerties and Marianne. Marianne, you're on. That's a weird sound.
Hi. Thank
Hi.
You.
Go ahead.
I inherited a 17th century blackamoor from my aunt when she passed away. It's probably about 4 feet tall, and it says Venetian. It has a lot of very detailed gold leaf painting on it, and just curious if there is a market for that type of thing. I've been told in the past that there really wasn't because of kind of the PC thing.
Marianne, I can be very definitive on this subject. There is no longer a market for this type of material. We have ceased selling this type of thing.
What is it?
It's a Moorish figure, which would be a North Arab, Southern African figure, and it generally is depicting, in many cases, a slave or a worker in a house.
Yeah.
And
it's not what the world
wants to live with. It's not what we want to think about anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid a lot of this has been cast aside. Now, it leaves a large orphanage full of this material of what to do, and I'm afraid I just don't have the answer to that one anymore. But I'm afraid, Marianne, they're not saleable anymore at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's what I had actually been told by a couple other people in the business. So you confirmed it. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Let's go now to Stanfordville. John, you're on.
Hi there. Through my wife's parents, we were left over 1,000 Stereopticon cards.
Oh, cool.
And positifs, which are our glass Stereopticon slides, and 5 viewers. I'm looking for either... Is there a market in them and a place to sell them, or someplace, a museum or something that we could donate them to for a tax deduction?
I think I'm going to ask Lisa's help here with this, but I think, John, a lot of it depends to do with subject matter.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
For instance, if they were of early Hawaii, right?
Or
if something like early Japanese territories or Japan.
Yeah.
So it really depends on what the subjects are displaying. They generally get sold at regional auction houses.
Right.
There's some ones that are quite early in the American history. So it depends really on what scenes are being depicted. And that would really, Lisa, don't you think? And then who made them?
I think it's very similar to the postcard caller that we had earlier. The variables in terms of value and rarity are going to be the same. But I think donating it is a wonderful idea. We always encourage that people ask us for options. And I would think that a library might be a good option for
maybe
a donation, or perhaps a college or university library.
You know, it's funny. When I was a kid, Bethlehem Public Library had a bunch of those. And then they moved locations in 72, and all those things were relegated to some storage.
Yeah.
They were never seen since, at least by me. But they were so cool. All right, we only have 1 minute here.
Yeah.
Let's go to Gloversville, because David's been waiting about a half an hour. David, you got to make it very fast, okay?
Yes, I have a Bruno Mathieson table that kind of collapses.
Mm-hmm.
It's in an M shape and it stretches out.
Sure.
I'm wondering how I can sell it and if it's worth anything.
Oh, it's definitely worth something. There was quite a bit of that type of furniture made at that period of time. It just depends on the model and the size and the condition. I'm assuming it's probably teak wood. Does that make sense?
It might be walnut.
Might be walnut. Could be walnut as well. But most definitely has some value. Sounds like a pretty...
How do I sell it?
You know, you get in touch with a local regional auction house, you keep in touch with them, you send some pictures, and you and they give you an idea of when it was made, what conditions in, et cetera, et cetera. I'm happy to help.
David, oops, I turned. Let's turn the mic off. It's okay, Zach. I turned my own mic off by mistake. All right, we're done. Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas, thank you so much for being here.
You betcha.
It was a lot of fun. And once again, the email address and the website for you guys.
Information at Stair Galleries, and have a look at stairgalleries.com. See what's going on.
Beautiful. It was great to have you both here. Support comes from Rhinebeck Artist Shop, offering fine artist materials and custom picture framing in Rhinebeck on New Paltz, serving the Hudson Valley for over 45 years. HudsonValleyArtistShops.com. And Saratoga Jewish Cultural Festival, presenting a Zoom discussion on the film Miss Jane Pittman, part of the Social Justice Series, September 8th, 7 p.m., SaratogaJewishArtsFestival.org. Once again, thanks to Colin Stair and Lisa Thomas of Stair Galleries for being here today. Thank you for listening. Apologies to the many people who couldn't get through today, either in email or on phone. We'll do this topic again. Rest assured. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who's something of an antique himself over there in Master Control. And Jordan Yuxall screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Dan DeLurie. We'll have another one of our regular discussions about climate change and emerging clean energy technologies. See you at 2:00.